Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Samach Ber Maralef, 10 lines down, Amar Rofa. So here again, we're talking about the Mazik of Eish. Gemara over here differentiated between Mazik of Eish that starts in his property and then spreads to the adjacent properties, versus Eish where he lights the Eish in his friend's property, that the liability is much higher when he lights the fire in his friend's property. We saw Rav Kahana who suggested that the Machloket in Tamun is only B'madlik Mitoch Shelo. But if he's madlik betoch shel chaviro, everyone agrees that tamun is chayav. We saw Rovo who suggested betarte pligay that they argue about both issues, whether you light in your own property and it spreads, whether you light in your friend's property. In both instances, there is a machloket. The nature of the machloket is different, which is that in your own property, the chachamim believe that you're completely patur, whereas Rabbi Yehuda believes that you're completely chayav for tamun. Whereas when you light in your friend's property, once again, Rabbi Yehuda thinks you're completely chayav for tamun. The chachamim agree, at least partially with him, that you're chayav for tamun for items that normally would be found there, but not for items that would not be found there. Here, Rova adds an additional qualification or dimension that, which is, anotein dinar zahav li'isha. Someone gives a golden coin to a woman. V'amar la, hizari bo, shel kesefu. Be careful with it, it's a silver coin. Hezikato, if she damages the coin, Mishalemet dinar zahav. She pays for a golden coin. Mishum da amalai, my havalech gabei das kitei. What came over you that you went ahead and damaged the coin? What type of right did you have to be mazik bi adayim over here? Now, this is important to the previous cases, because if you remember in the breita that we finished off with yesterday, the breita spoke about instances where a person had permission to put se'orim there. And instead of putting Seorim, he puts Chitim, and then he covered them in Seorim, or he put down Seorim and covered them in Chitim. So both Rashi and the Balei HaTosafot say, why is this individual who is Mazik over there only Chayav for Demei Seorim and not Chitim? Here Rova makes the statement that if you know what the object is, like here by the woman where she knows it's Zahav instead of Kesef, and she damages it, even though he said, I'm giving you a silver coin to watch, in the end, if it's a gold coin, she was responsible for the gold coin because she damaged it by Yadayim. So why don't we say the same thing in that previous case where, yes, they had permission with regards to the Seorim, but he put Chitim there, the guy sees Chitim, why isn't he responsible for Chitim? So Rashi and Tosafot both address this issue. Rashi says that the case of Mavilech Gabedas Kte B'Yadayim, over here you did it B'Yadayim, whereas by the case of the Chitim, it's Afo Pishnoten Lo Rishut the Chitim, Enu Mishalem Seorim, Damarleh, Lo Ra'iti El Seorim. I only saw Serim, Lefikach Lo Nizarati Ben Kokach. That's all I saw over here. And the Balei HaTosafot say about that, B'madlik B'toch Shel Lo Ayri. Talking about a case where he lights the fire in his own property. D'madlik B'toch Shel Chaviro. If you lit the property in your friend's property, and it was Serim, and you put Chitim, Lama Lo Yishalim Chitim. Why wouldn't you have to pay for Chitim? Came into Chazilo, because you could see them, they're physically there. They're physically there, we're saying over here, in the case of the Zahav, if you know what is there, and you know what you're damaging, and you damage it, you're responsible for whatever you damage. So therefore, the Balei HaTosafot say that the case here of damaging B'Yadayim, but the case of Zahav is literally B'Yadayim, she damages it. Whereas the case by the Eish has to be a scenario where he lit it in his own property and then spread to the adjacent property. And there it makes a difference that he had only permission for Seorim and not Chitim, because seeing the Chitim is not relevant over there. Seeing the chitim is relevant when you're talking about you're being mazik b'yadayim. But when you light it in your own property and it spreads there, that's not called mazik b'yadayim. Therefore, Tosfot is forced to suggest that the case by the Seorim and chitim is a case where you lit in your own property in order to avoid a stira with what we have over here. And Rashi does the same thing by saying, Lo dami l'mashil makom l'chaviro l'akdish Seorim v'akdish chitim d'amran l'hel, en mashil l'madabe Seorim d'mavir lo mazik b'yadayim hu. It's considered to be a posheya, not a mazik b'yadayim. Rashi earlier on said that a madlik b'toch chaviro is considered to be a mazik b'yadayim. And so therefore Rashi must be in the end saying the same thing that the Balei HaTosafot are saying, which is that this is someone who lit a fire in his own property and not in someone else's property. Now this woman who took this gold coin and was told that it was a silver coin, if she damages it physically with her own yadayim, she's chayav for a gold coin. Pash'abo, if she was negligent in watching it, mishalemet shel kesef, then she only has to pay back silver. The amrlei nitiruta de kaspa kabili alai. I only accepted to watch it like a silver coin. Nituyuta de havalo kabili alai. I didn't accept the responsibility or the threshold of proper security with regards to a gold coin. I only accept it for a silver coin, and I'm responsible for a silver coin. You learn this din from Rava. Anan me matrita pshitalan. We learn this out of the Braita, not from Rava's statement. Chitin v'chipan b'seurim. If there was wheat, and then you covered it with barley. Seurim v'chipan v'chitin. It was barley, it was covered in wheat. Einu mishalem ala demei seurim bilvad. You only pay for demei seurim. Alama, why are you only paying for seurim? Amalei nitiruta desari kabili alai. Because you're going to say, I only accept the responsibility for barley. I did not accept responsibility of chitin. Hachanami amalei nitiruta dehava lo kabili alai. And she can make the same statement to him. When the item is stolen from her negligence, is that I accept the responsibility for a silver coin. I did not accept the responsibility for a gold coin. And therefore, I'd only have to replace a silver coin, not a gold coin. So they learned this out of the diuk of the Braita, rather than from Rava's statement, because the Braita seemingly is giving the same type of information, which is that once you have permission for Se'orim, even though if you put Chitim there, if you're posheya by them, not when a case where there's an esh, but in a case where you're posheya, either because you lit the esh in your own property and went there, or because you were negligent in watching it, then you're a chayav for seurim and not for chitim. Amarav, shameit milta the Rabbi Yehuda, v'lo yadana mahi. I heard something in the name of Rabbi Yehuda or from Rabbi Yehuda, but I don't know exactly what it is. So now, we know that Rabbi Yehuda is found in our Mishnah, we know that Rabbi Yehuda is mechayev, B'tamun ba'esh. So seemingly that would be the statement that Rav is referencing, and he's probably not saying that he doesn't know what Rabbi Yehuda says, because you know what Rabbi Yehuda says, but rather there is some sort of statement about or qualification of the statement of Yehuda that Rav forgot. So Amar Shmuel, v'leihu d'Abba, mai shmilei d'Rabbi Yehuda. So Rav Shmuel says to Rav, Abba, now Abba is a question in the Rishonim, whether Abba is a term of endearment. And Shmuel called Rav Abba out of respect and endearment because Rav was older than him. And because of that, he called him Abba as a term of respect. Or is Abba Rav's real name? And because Shmuel was a peer with Rav, he called him by his real name. On the other hand, everybody else called him Rav because he was the Murad Atra, basically, of Bavel. And so he was given that accolade of Rav being the Rebbe of everyone. And that's why they called him Rav. But Shmuel, who knew him as a peer, called him Abba. That's a machloket the Mishonim as to whether Abba is a term of endearment and kavod, or is it actually his proper name? So he says, Rav, you don't know what Rabbi Yehuda says, but this is what Rabbi Yehuda says. The mechayev on this kei tamun ba'ish. That part we know, that's explicit in the Mishnah, but this is the important addition, asu takanat nigzal ba'isho. That when it comes to repayment of Eish, they made takanat nigzal. Now, takanat nigzal is a takanah that allows a person who's been robbed to take a shvu'ah to claim from the thief exactly what was stolen. So here, if we have a situation in which there's clear evidence that a gozlan came and stole from the nigzal, so we have independent corroboration, we have third-party evidence of the fact that there was a theft here, then how do we assess what was taken? So you have the nigzal who's making a claim, and you have the gazlan who might deny the claim, might not deny the claim. Chachamim empowered the nigzal in this situation to take a shvu'ah and to list what he lost. I mean, that's like an insurance claim over here. He's coming along, he's going to list all the items that were taken by the gazlan, and he's given nemanut to take a shvu'ah as to what was taken by the gazlan, what is missing from his house. So midoraita, the Mishnayot and Shvuot tell us that midoraita, the only type of shvua you have is nishba v'niftar. You take a shvua and you are patur. There are dine d'rabanan, shvuot d'rabanan, which involve taking a shvua and being notel, which is called nishba v'notel. This is one of those takanot chachamim, one of those shvuot d'rabanan, that allows a person to take a shvua v'notel, and then you collect based on that shvua. In each case, or any time we have that, it's an institution of the chachamim that allows the individual to take a shvua. Part of the problem is the other party here is a gazlan, and therefore he's not ne'aman. If he's not ne'aman, then we flip the shvu'ah to the other party. That's number one. And number two is, this is we'll call it a disincentive and a deterrence for the gazlan not to take things, because if he is caught, and then we have to establish facts over here, We're going to allow the party to make his claim for that which was stolen. We're going to empower him to take a shvua. So he's going to get the short end of the stick here. And so that might be a disincentive for stealing, because if you're caught, you're going to be penalized for that, which is that someone else is going to dictate the terms of how this is going to be settled. So now over here, the Gemara's point is that by Tamun Ba'esh, we face the similar problem, which is Tamun Ba'esh, by definition, the person who lit the fire and burnt the thing down has no idea what's inside of the pile that he burnt down, because that's why it's called Tamun Ba'esh. It's a hidden, it's something that's not visible to the people around. And then the Chachamim in this instance empowered the individual who has items that were Tamun Ba'esh to come take a Shavua and collect based on that. And that's what Shmuel is saying to Rav. Isn't that what you heard about Rabbi Yehuda? That there's Takanat Nigzal extends to the Mazik of Esh. As the Balei Tosafot point out, this is not unique to the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda, but it would be true of the Shita of the Chachamim as well. First of all, we saw yesterday's daf that the Chachamim agreed by Bira, by the case of a house or a large estate, that people keep things there. And if you burn it down, then you're also going to be chayav for tamun in that case, because that's expected to be there. There are items that you would expect to be in there in that case. Or gadish. If you lit the fire in your friend's field and it's in a gadish, they also say that the clay bakar and the morigim that are expected to be found there, you are chayav. So even according to the Chachamim, we also have instances in Tamun Ba'esh where you're going to be chayav. And so the question could be equally asked on the Chachamim as it is on Rabbi Yehuda, or the need for a Takanat Nigzal exists for the Chachamim as well as Rabbi Yehuda. The reason that we might focus on Rabbi Yehuda is because Rabbi Yehuda is Mechayev on everything. And since Mechayev on everything, there, the fact that you can take a Shavuah and collect it is a clear bonus, or it is beyond what you would have said is the quote-unquote normal items that are there. It's anything that this individual now declares to have been Tamun Ba'esh. So now, Bayam Eimar, Asu Takanat Nigzal B'Masor Olo. When it comes to a moser is someone that gives over information to the authorities or turns over the property of his friend to the authorities, and then the friend's property is then confiscated or taken by the authorities. So here is an individual who facilitated the government basically taking away his friend's property. That's called a moser. So now, a person who is a masur, did this Takanat Nigzal extend also to this scenario? Because just like by Tamun Ba'esh, we're facing a similar problem, which is that this person had property or items taken away, and those items that were taken away, he wants to make a claim against the person that caused that. So when he comes to make a claim, can he take a shvua declaring exactly what's taken? Mar says, Aliba demanda amar lo dainin dine gami. According to one who says that, we do not adjudicate cases of gami lo ti bayalach. There's no question here. The Misirut, Nami Lo Dainina. Then, because in the case of Moser, there's no din, because it's a din of Garmi. It's not direct causation. It is indirect causation, but indirect causation that results in a loss, and indirect causation that can be directly attributed to you. So even though it's Garmi, that's Machloket, whether we're Dan Dinig the Garmi or not. So if you believe that we're not Dan Dinig Garmi, then there's nothing to speak about over here, because you're not Chayav. The question is really relevant. According to one who says, we do adjudicate cases of Garmi. So here, this is a case of Garmi. The question is, now that we establish a case of Garmi and you're Chayav, Asu Takanat Nigzal B'Masor D'Mishtaba V'Shakil, did they make such a Takanat and extend it also to the case of Moser, that the person who was the victim of the person who gave over the property to the authorities, does he take a shvua and then collects whatever it is, olo, or not, teku, that we leave as unresolved? So the question here, do we extend this takanat nigzal beyond the cases of gezela itself? Here the Gemara first entertains that esh, the mazik of esh, is also incorporated under this takana. And now the Gemara is going even further to extend it not only from gezel, where it's the original institution, to esh, also now to the case of moser. In the case of Moser, you can see in the Balei Tosafot already, just by the way that he lays it out, that there is clearly a number of machlokot, rishonim, that revolve around this case of Moser. The first one, you can see this in the Tosafot, Katav Rav Alfas, Kagon Sheish Edim, Shemasro. Similar to the case of Gezel, where you have Edim that testify to the fact that there was actually Gezel that took place, so too over here, you need Edim to testify that this individual turned over the other party's property. And therefore he caused the loss. V'ein yodim kama. And now we don't know how much. Teku. So that's the way that the Rif explains over here, that the case of Moser is no different than the case of Nigzal. And in both those cases, what we have is evidence, third-party evidence, as to the fact that there was a theft here, or there was a problem here. And now we're trying to establish what exactly is the value of that which was taken. There, the Chachamim empowered the individual to take a Shvu'ah in order to collect. That's true by the case of Gezel. By the case here of Moser, the Gemara left it as a Teku, was uncertain as to whether we would extend this din to Moser as well. Tosfot also adds another qualification, which is Rabbeinu Tam Meforesh Tach Baya Kishe Moser Machisha Tanimsar. That this whole question here, it revolves on a case where the Moser denies wrongdoing, or he's denying the amount that was taken. So because of that, he now is in a predicament where we have questions, because we can't necessarily believe the Moser, and we can't necessarily believe the Nimsar. So who do we believe? That's why you give him power, the Nimsar, to take a Shvua. That's only because the Moser is denying the facts, or denying what transpired over here. Domya de Nigzal b'shvult, the Gazlan machishon. Same way by the case of Nigzal, where it's like a Shvua, that the Gazlan is machisho. The Gazlan over there disagrees and says, that's not what I took, I didn't take that much. Aval ima Moser atzmo eino yodeya. The person who is Moser doesn't know himself. The kama ishava nimsar kama ifsid vitol. In that case, Rabbeinu Tam says that the question, there's no take over there. Clearly, if there's no objection, either because he lacks the knowledge, or there's no objection because there's uncertainty, over there, clearly the nimsar, a person's property was taken, could take a shvu'ah and declare what he lost. The Reed disagrees with the Rabbeinu Tam and says this is even in a situation where the Moser doesn't know. That's similar to the case of Eish, where you have no idea what was Tamun there. So here you have competing models by which you're trying to establish what the facts are here by the Moser. You have the model of Zeila, which says that the individual knows what he stole, and now there's a disagreement between them, and that's why we have a question in that case. In the case of Eish, you have Tamun Be'ish, and then it's burnt down, and the Nizak says this is what was in there. Now the Mazik can try to disagree, but why would he know what was in there? His only real claim is that shouldn't have been in there, or that's not normal to be in there. But he can't make a claim that wasn't in there, because how does he know? How does he know definitively that, was the case? And so therefore we empower the person who was damaged here to take a shvuah to collect on what was tamun beish for Yehuda in all cases, and for the Chachamim in the cases that we discussed above. But that leads you then to a question about the model of Moser. Is Moser like a Gazlan? By the case of the Gazlan is objecting to the Nigzal's claim because he knows. He stole it and he knows and he's objecting. Or do we compare it to the case of Eish, whereby Eish, it's clear that the person who set the fire has no idea what was tamun in this pile over there, and since he has no idea what was tamun in the pile, then he can't deny it. And if that's the case, also here by the Moser, even if the individual doesn't deny it, has no idea what was given up, he would still be responsible, and he would take a shvuah, then it would fall under the rubric of what the Gemara says is a teku. Then the Gemara, when it says teku over here, is a question about a teku. Generally, a teku means we have a stalemate, or we have a safek. In general, when it comes to sfekot by mamonot, we either apply the generally sfek mamon kula, but or more likely the term is hamotzi michavero alav araya, and you should be patur ligamre. And that is what the Elie Tosafot say over here, v'chol teiku di mamona lekula. Anytime you have a case of teiku in mamon, it goes the kula, because it's a sfek in mamon, and sfek mamon always goes the kula, because hamotzi michavero alav araya. Now then, b'shem rav hai gaon, Rav Haigon says, "Katuv shishavavi to mechza." In this case, where the Moser, he takes the shvuah and he collects half of it. So kol teiku di mamona chokim. When it comes to a teiku by mamon, it means that we are dealing with a safek, not a safek where we say safek the kula or motzi mechavaleh varaya, but rather a safek shakul, which means that we have an even balanced safek over here. We have uncertainty that's basically 50-50, and since we don't know which way to go, we say chokim, split the money or split the difference. And therefore, based on that, the Rav Chai going over here says that the teiku means chokim, that they split it, or that he only collects half of the claim that he has. All right, now the Gemara continues. How gavra de botosh bekasefta de chavre. This individual went ahead and kicked the safe of his friend. Shaja Banara, and that kick was a pretty good kick, and it sent it flying into the river. Atamare, the owner of the safe, comes along and says, Vamar Haki Vachi Avali Begava. Such and such, he gives an inventory of items that were inside of this safe. Yotav Rav Ashi become an ayin bay. Ki agavna mai. He was looking into the matter and says, in this scenario, what would you do? Amale Ravina, the Rav Acha, Bre de Rova, Vamri lo Rav Acha, Bre de Rova, the Rav Ashi, Lav Hainu Matnitin. Isn't that our Mishnah? That's not Umodim Chachamin Reyuda, but Madlikat Abira, Shemeshalim, Komashi Betocho. That when it comes to the Chachamim's position with regards to Tamun Beish, they agree when you light a house on fire, that anything that's in it, you're chayav for. Shekein derech b'nei adam laniach bebatim. Because people keep items in their house. It's normal for them to store items in their house. Samalei, ikatayin zuzei hachanami. He says, if the guy was making claim for cash, then he would say that he's right. Because the kasefet, a safe, usually contains cash inside of it. So it's no different than a tamun be'esh, because here it is. Tamun inside the kasefet, but it's a normal item that would be found there, similar to items normally be found in a house. And so for that reason, you are chayav in that case. But that's not the question here. Hacha dekata ayin marganita. Over here he's making a claim that there was a precious stone in there. There was a diamond. There was some valuable stone in there besides the money. Mai, mi manche inche marganita bekasefta. Do people put or store jewelry or expensive precious stones inside of the safe? Although, or maybe not, teku, again here, left unresolved, or uncertain as to what the halacha should be here with regards to whether people keep jewels or precious stones or diamonds inside of their kasefet. And as the Balei Tosafot point out over here, the question does not just revolve around whether we believe this individual is taking the shvuah, but if it's something that is not normal to be kept there, then even if you have a dut, you have a dim who come along and tell us that that object was in there, maybe the individual is not chayav because it's tamun, and if it's not a normal item to be kept there, you're not chayav for tamun in that case. The Rashba disagrees with the Balei Tosafot over here and says, even in a scenario where it's unusual to keep such an item here, if we have a dud brura, if a din to come and tell us that that was in there and that object was in there, then the person who takes the shvua is believed, and you have to compensate for it. The question for Ravashi is only in an instance where we're uncertain as to the facts, and we're trying to establish the facts by a shvua. Are you believed in that shvua because this is an unusual item to be found there? And maybe that diminishes your believability even with a shvua. The person says that I had a silver goblet in my house or in my property. My, what's the din? If this person is a person of stature, wealthy individual, did lay casa de caspo, that it would be plausible that he has a silver goblet, inami inish mehemna, or is this someone who is a trustworthy individual, demifka de inish gabe, and people therefore store items with him and keep, give it to him for safekeeping, mishtabe vishakil. So then he takes the shvua and takes it. So even though he himself could not afford it, but nevertheless, since he's a trustworthy individual, people leave with him items that he himself couldn't afford, but that means when he's speaking about an item that was in there, he could be telling the truth about it, because it makes sense that there might be something like that. Below, if he has neither of those, meaning that he's not wealthy, and he's not an individual who's trustworthy that people deposit things with, lav kol kumine, then he doesn't have a right to make a claim like that. He can only make a claim for things that are normal to keep within this item. Otherwise, you are not chayav for them. What's the difference between a gazlan and chamsan? Again, this seems almost to be, it's a little bit of a sidebar here, not really connected necessarily directly to our Gemara. But he says then, what's the difference between a gazlan and chamsan? Chamsan yad dami, that the chamsan takes something forcibly, but he pays for it. On the other hand, gazlan lo yoy dami, but the gazlan does not give or does not pay money for it. Amalei, wait a minute, if he pays for it, then he's called a chamsan? Doesn't Ravuna tell us, we had this in the Gemara in Gitin with regards to Shmitat Ksafim. Talua v'zavin, if the guy hangs him up on a tree, and then he agrees to a sale, zvine zvine, then the sale is a good sale. But there we had a machloket between Rashi and the Balei Tosafot as to how literally you take this. Does it really mean string him up on the tree? And if he agrees, then of course he meant it. Or does it mean that we put pressure on him to do this, but not that we actually compel him in a physical force way to do this. And the guy says, Lokasha, that's not a problem. Hada marotzeani, delo marotzeani. In the case where he says, I agree, rotzeani, I wanted to sell it. I'm agreeable to selling it. In that case, the sale is a good sale. On the other hand, when he says, lo marotzeani, never agreed to it, never says, I want to do this, then that's called chamas. That's called chamas, because even though you paid for it, you stole it. Now the Baal Tosafot over here already point out, he says, Belishtan dekra ain chiluk b'nehem. When it comes to Hamas and Gezel, in terms of the Psukim, there is no distinction between them, meaning that they're synonyms. And the whole question here revolves about whether this is Gezel, when we're talking about someone derabanan. Is a person classified as a Gazlan midrabanan or a Chamsan midrabanan? Because, according to the Torah, there really are two models of theft. There's a model of theft where the person hides and does it in a cover of darkness or underhanded manner where people don't know. Or there's a gazlan who steals in open daylight, has no qualms about people seeing him. And a chamsan is the same thing. A gazlan and a chamsan, again, are synonymous in that way, which is that they do as they please. They don't worry about what people think, and they don't worry about the fact that they're going to get caught. They take it. So this distinction of paying or not paying is a categorization, derabanan, to distinguish within Lashon Chachamim between a gazlan and a chamsan. That's what Baal Tosfot say. The question of the Gemara revolves around this categorization, derabanan, who's a gazlan and who's a chamsan. The answer of the Gemara is a gazlan steals without paying. A chamsan takes it and then pays for it, even though he never asked permission for it. He never was given the right by the seller. But nevertheless, he imposes on that person and has them sell the object to them for the money or whatever price that is set by him. That's what over here points out again. Now, Chamsan, who, Yaib Dami, who pays for it. And the only case where it's true is when a case where the guy doesn't blow my rotani. It's where the victim of the theft does not say, I really wanted to, or I am happy with this sale. Aval mina Torah, ein psul elahecha delo yaib dami. That the only time you're psul, or the only time it impacts, is when you didn't give any money. Elahecha delo yaib dami kasher. Mina Torah, if you pay for it, you are a kasher. Afagav delo my rotani. Even without this special acknowledgement of Rotzeani, Afa Pisho Ober Alav de Lo Tachmod, even though you're in violation of the mitzvah or the negative precept of Lo Tachmod. This brings us to a sugya that appears in Sanhedrin. It's a Gemara in Baba Metzia as well. We're going to see it in Heyam Bet in Baba Metzia, which is what's the nature of Lo Tachmod? Not be jealous of someone else's property. There are a number of Shitot within the Rishonim as to what the real Isser of Lo Tachmod is. We'll see when we get there in Bava Metzia, Machloket Eben Ezra, the Ramban, and others as to exactly how to explain the issue of Lo Tachmod. But Tosafot over here points out that in a case where an individual steals from someone, but steals in the following manner, they take the item against the will without the permission of the other party, they pay them for it fully, but the other party never says, Rotze Ani, he never agrees to it. That's what it says over here, that Mina Torah, that person is Kasher Mina Torah, he's not a Pasul Eidut, he's not a Pasul Deshua Mina Torah. This individual is fine Mina Torah, with the exception of the fact that he's violated the Isur Doraita of Lo Tachmod. But Lo Tachmod does not have the ramifications of being called a Gazlan, because being called a Gazlan is Pusel you from Eidut, it is sell you from a shvuah. It does a lot of things that, quote unquote, ruin your reputation. But Tosafot says, so despite that fact that you're not in violation of Lo Tigzol, you are in violation of Lo Tachmod. The Tosafot in Baba Metzia suggests otherwise, that maybe you're chayav for both Lo Tachmod and Lo Tigzol, and that the Lo Tachmod just comes to reinforce the Easter of Lo Tigzol. But nevertheless, the Tosafot over here separates between the two and says that you can be in violation of Lo Tachmod midoraita, as long as paid money, and you're not in violation of Lo Tigzol. The other to be in violation of Lo Tigzol, which is something that's posel you midoraita, you would have to have stolen without any compensation, irrespective of whether the seller says Rotzeani or does not say Rotzeani. And then Tosafot goes on to ask about a Toyin Tanat Ganav by a Shomer who claims that he was stolen from, and therefore he could then, based on that, a Shomer Chinam take a Shvua and be patur. And he decides, instead of taking the Shvua, he'd much rather pay the money. And so he pays the money. So Tosafot over there says that's an individual who stole. He kept the pikadon. He stole it. And he really didn't pay for it. The only reason he paid for it is because to get out of the Shavua. Had we not compelled him to take the Shavua, he wouldn't have paid for it. So why isn't that person deemed to be a gazlan? The Gemara answers because he's Mora Heter Latzmo. He's Mora Heter to himself because he paid money for it. Thus it says, what do you mean Mora Heter Latzmo? He paid money for it. The only reason he paid money was to get out of the Shavua. It wasn't because he really wanted to pay for the object that he stole. And so Tosafot in the end says that maybe maybe that's not the only reason why he's paying the money here, and if he didn't have to take a shvua, he might have still paid the money. And therefore, because he basically justifies it to himself, or talks himself into being that it's a heter, this person does not become classified as a gazlan, but remains kasher to take a shvua, and we don't say migo, that he's kashur ha-mamona, he's kashur ha-shvuata, because this person ended up paying for the item. And since he paid for the item, he's not considered to be a chashud or a gazlan midoraita. And if he's midorabanan over here, we give him a waiver because of the fact that he might justify or talk himself into the fact that it was mutar because he paid for it. Right now, the Mishnah begins on the top of the Amud Bet. Gates, sheyatza mitoch karta patish. You have a spark that shoots out from under the hammer of the blacksmith. Vezik, and it does damage. Chayav is responsible for that. And that he knows the extent of his work and the type of incidental type of damage that comes about, and he has to protect against it. If he doesn't, he's chayav. Gamal shayaton pishtan vavar b'shut rabim. This is something we saw all the way back in the beginning of Masechta, as well as in Bamei Likin, Gemara in Shabbat. And if you have a gamal who's loaded up with pishtan vavar b'shut rabim, it's going through the public thoroughfare. V'nichnas pishtano l'tochanut, and his pishtan, his flax goes into the store of the storekeeper. V'dalku b'neiro shel chenvani, and then it catches fire with the lighting or the candle of the chenvani, but that was inside of his store where the pishtan caught fire. And then that causes a burning of house. He spreads the fire by moving around. Balagamal chayav. Here the balagamal is chayav because his overloading of the gamal is what caused the flax to go inside the store and him to be responsible. And here chenvani nero b'chutz. On the other hand, if the chenvani puts his fire outside, which is a danger to the rabim, and he's therefore violating, let's call it the building code or the civil code there, then a chenvani chayav. The chenvani is responsible in that case because he is the posheya in that instance. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, b'ner Chanukah patur. Rabbi Yehuda says that if the reason he has a light outside is because he's lighting Nerot Chanukah, in that case he is patur because, as we'll see in the Gemara, he has a right to put it out there because of the mitzvah. Amar Ravina Mishmei D'Rabba, Shmamina D'Rabbi Yehuda, Ner Chanukah mitzvah l'nicha, b'toch asara. That it must be that the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah is to put it within 10 tefachim of the ground. If you think that you can place it above 10 tefachim, amai Rabbi Yehuda Ner Chanukah patur. Why does Rabbi Yehuda grant you an exemption by Ner Chanukah? Should say to him, you should have placed it above the height of a camel and its rider. You should have put it high up so that there wouldn't ever be an issue where something could catch fire to it. You can say, that's what compels him to keep it down low. And then since he keeps it down low, he's not responsible if it catches fire. On the other hand, if there was an equal opportunity to put the mitzvah up higher, and he just chose not to do that, then maybe there he should be culpable because it wasn't necessary to put it the Ner Chanukah or the Nerot Chanukah in a dangerous location. No, that's not true. That you could place the Chanukah lich. You could put it below 10 tefachim, above 10 tefachim. Mayamart, Ibayla lanucha lamalam, Igamal verochvo. Your suggestion is, well, if that's the case, why doesn't he put it above the camel and its rider? Kevin the mitzvah ko'osik kulehai lo achuchu rabbana. Since this individual is involved in a mitzvah, and we're asking him to light outside in the Rishut Rabim, the Chachamim didn't push him further and say, okay, not only you have to light out in the Rishut Rabim, but you got to put it all the way up there so as clearance for anybody who's going through the Rishut Rabim. That the Chachamim already did not want to bother him with that extra effort. And so therefore, even if the mitzvah is not to place it under 10 tefachim, you still have a right to place it out there in a lower location because that's the nature of a mitzvah, the Chachamim waive your responsibility or liability in that case because you're performing the mitzvah. Now, it's just interesting to note over here, the reason that the Gemara is speaking about the fact that the Chanukah candle should be lit under 10 tefachim, even though in the end the Gemara rejects it as being a proof from our Mishnah, nevertheless, many of the poskim feel and the Chatchila, one should put their Nerot Chanukah below 10 tefachim. Now, in the modern day where you have electric lights, this is less meaningful. But in a time period in which the default manner by which you lit your house at night was candles, then how does one distinguish between candles that are used for light in the house and candles that are Neirot Chanukah? So the answer to that question is to put the Neirot Chanukah in a place that doesn't really have utility or doesn't make sense. When you place Chanukah candles outside on your porch or outside your door, if you're using it for light, you put it up on the edges of the doors, you put it like sconces outside of the doorway. And then if you put it down on the floor, just sitting within 10 tefachim of the floor, which is very low down, it's clearly indicating that these lit candles over here are not for the purpose of light, but simply for the purpose of the mitzvah. So putting it under 10 tefachim is a way to indicate that this light or this candle is not here for its utility, but simply for the purpose of indicating that it's a mitzvah. Ner Chanukah that's placed above 20 amot is pasul, the same way that a sukkah is, and the same way that a mavoi. Here it's talking about the korah of the mavoi. So this is identical to a gemara that's found in the beginning, the first amud of sukkah, Masechet Sukkah. And Tosfot over here comments similar to what he says over there. But let's just establish what the situation is. With the sukkah, the schach has to be below 20 amot from the ground. Different reasons given there in the gemara as to why that is the case. One of them is the lo shalta be'eino, that people do not see things that are above 20 amot. And part of the mitzvah of sitting in the sukkah is to be aware of the fact that you're under the schach, and through that to remember the reason you're in the sukkah. And so, since the schach and the seeing of the schach play an important role in the sukkah, we want it to be below 20 amot, which is the normal peripheral vision of the individual, and they will catch their eye or they will see such a thing. Similarly, by mavui is a korah. If you have a mavui, which is a side street coming off of the Rishut Rabim, that then leads into multiple chatzerot, if the multiple chatzerot want to get together and make it into a single mavui, where they'll all be able to carry from all the different chatzerot into the mavui and back again, if it's a three-walled mavui, I mean it's a side street that has three walls around, it's open on the fourth side to the Rishut Rabim, they have to put up a lechi or a korah at the end of the road to identify the fact that this is the end of the area of the mavoi. Aside from the shituf mavot that they have to do, they have to put a demarcation. That demarcation can be a lechi, which is a standing pole, or a korah, a beam that goes across the top. Over there, the Mishnah says that if it's above 20 amot, that the korah is not good. For the same reason, lo shalta be'eino, people don't see it. Since they don't see it, it's not going to be valuable as a demarcation of the end of the place where you can carry before you enter into Rishut HaRabim. And now similarly by Ner Chanukah, there is the same din that you can't place it the malami 20 amot, because as Rashi says over here, lo chazule inshay, people don't see it. Velo mifarsim nisa, and therefore there's no pursum anes, v'anon lipsur anisa bina. And that's the whole point of Neirot Chanukah, is the farsim et anes. You've defeated the purpose by putting it above 20 amot, because it is not visible. So therefore we compare these three items. These three items all have the same din, which is Neirot Chanukah, Sukkah and Mavoi, all of which it's important. The sighting of the item is important in the Kiyuma Mitzvah. And so all of them have the same requirement that it be below 20 Amot. Tosfot over here asks, why doesn't the Gemara say, instead of saying Psula, just say Yima'it? You should bring it down, you should lower the height. Because the Gemara in Sukkah itself makes a distinction between a Dindo Raita, where you would say psula in order to prevent people from violating the din d'oraita, versus a din d'rabbanan, where you actually put in the takana, you say yima'et, just bring it down and it'll be kasher. So that's the way the Gemara explains the difference between sukkah, which is d'oraita, where the Mishnah says it's psula when it's above 20 amot, and the case of eruvin, where the mavoi, when it's above 20 amot, the Mishnah there says yima'et, bring it down. So Tosfos wants to know over here, by Neirot Chanukah, which is a din d'rabbanan also, why don't you just say yima'et? You should bring it down, lower it. So Tosfot gives two answers to that question. The first is, Mishum de Baile Meimar Kesukah Nakat Lashom Psula. Since over here it's incorporating not just Neirot Chanukah and the Mavoi, but it's also including the case of Sukkah. So as a catch-all for all of them, it says that it's Psula, even though for two of them you possibly could just lower it and it'd be a better situation. Then Tosfot gives a second answer, is Inami, that there's a problem here, because we know, based on the Gemara in Shabbat, that a lokos a mitzvah. When it comes to the lighting of the Neirot Chanukah, the lighting itself is what's the kiyum a mitzvah. So therefore, to suggest yima'et, that you will simply take it from the higher location and bring it down to the lower location, that won't help you. Unless you believe Hanachos a mitzvah, then you need to light the candles in the proper location. And therefore, Imaita is not a good solution. But what you could have written, Baal Tosafot say, is that you could have written Yichaber v'Imaita v'Yachzor v'Yadlik. That he should blow it out, move it down to the proper location, and relight. The reason that he says that the Gemara, or the Braita, doesn't do that is because it's too much wordy. It's too wordy. It's too much to say. Better off just saying psula than trying to give all these instructions about how to rectify the problem or rectify the situation. All right, with that we end the sixth parak, Adon Alach Akones. So now we begin the seventh parak, which is a shift within the Gemara above the Kama. Until now we were dealing with the Mazikim of Mimono, Mazikim of his possessions that did damage. Here we're starting to shift over to Adama Mazik, the individual himself who does damage. He can do damage either physically through his yadayim, he can do damage to his dibur, through that which he states. He can do damage because of his pshia, because he is negligent. And here are the Mishnayot and the Gemara deal with all these different scenarios and the obligations involved with them. So, merubah midat tashlumei kefel mimidat tashlumei arba'a v'chamisha. The requirement to pay double when you're caught as a ganav is more stringent than if you're caught as a ganav that steals a short aseh, and that is toveach o mocher, either shechs it or sells it, then he's chayav arba v'chamisha, four times or five times, depending on the animal. Shemidat tashlumei kefil noaget, ben ben davar sheish baruach chayim, ben davar sheim baruach chayim. You pay kefil both for animate and inanimate objects, meaning whether it's livestock or live animals or inanimate objects, you still pay tashlumei kefil for them, and we'll see why in a second. When it comes to the tashlum of arba'a v'chamisha, it's uniquely true of a shor aseh, a shor or a seh, because it says in the pasuk, "Ignov ish shor aseh, utivacho mecharo." So there's the scenario, and the scenario set up is a case of shor aseh, which is only balei chayim. Ein agonev achar ganav mishalem tashlumei kefil. A thief that steals from a thief does not pay kefil, because it says v'gunav mibeit ish, that it was stolen from the owner's property, but not the gunav me ganav. Not that it was stolen from the ganav. V'lo atoveach v'lo mecher achar agonev mishalem tashlumei arba'a v'chamisha. Similarly, a person who shechs or sells it after taking it from the ganav, he also will not have to pay four or five times. Mer says then, v'ilu midat tashlumei kefil noheget ben beganav ben betoein tanat ganav. So based on this Mishnah, it would seem that kefil is applicable both in a case where the individual steals and then is caught and has to pay kefil, as well as the case with Tuein Tanat Ganav, where the individual who is a shomer chinam, says that the item was stolen from me. He was watching an item, he was taking care of an item, and he says it was stolen from me. If he takes a shvua to the fact that it was stolen from him, and then he's later caught as being the thief himself, he pays kefil. So what the Gemara is saying over here is that the fact that tashlumei kefil noheget ben beganav ben betoein tanat ganav, midat tashlumei kefil chamishayin noheget en lo beganav bilvad lo ktani, that's not written in the Mishnah. I mean, this distinction between tashlumei kefil tashlumei arba v'chamisha by toein tanat ganav, then the Mishnah should have included that as a difference between tashlumei kefil and arba v'chamisha, which is that tashlumei kefil is equally applicable to a ganav as a toein tanat ganav. Whereas midat arba'a v'chamisha, tashlumei arba'a v'chamisha, only apply to a ganav, but not to toein tanat ganav. So, why is that, that the Mishnah leaves it out? It must have left it out because it believes that that is not the case. And that means that by toein tanat ganav, the individual is chayav for kefil and chayav arba'a v'chamisha. And that distinction or difference doesn't exist. By toein tanat ganav, you can be chayav kefil and you also can be chayav arba'a v'chamisha. The lack of that difference being mentioned in the Mishnah is evidence of the fact that there isn't such a difference. That would help the position of Rabbi Chiya b'Abba. Someone who is a shomer that makes a claim that it was stolen from him in order to exempt himself from repayment and is found to be the thief, he will pay kefil. If he's found to be the thief and he also was toveach or mocher, he shechted it or sold it, you pay the four or five times. So you see here, according to Reb Chiya b'Abba, the din of kefil and the din of arba v'chamisha apply not only to a ganav, but also to a toein tanat ganav. And their proof is from the fact that our Mishnah doesn't bring down such a distinction. Ikadam made some phrase it this way. Lema misaylet Rabbi Chir Bava. This is a proof to Rabbi Chir Bava's position. Rabbi Chir Bava, Rabbi Yochanan, Twain Tanat, Ganav, Pikadom, Shalem, Teshlumi Kefil, Tavachu Machar, Shalem, Teshlumi Arvar, Bechamisha. That is what we will prove from our Mishnah. The fact that the Mishnah makes no distinction is evidence of the fact that Rabbi Chir Bava is right. My answer is no. Miktoni ain't bane. It's not a classic Mishnah where it's comparing items and saying there's no difference between this, A, and B. And therefore, we assume when he write Ein Bein, that's an exhaustive or complete list. But here, the Mishnah doesn't use the term Ein Bein, but rather Merubah, Dani. Merubah means that it's not an exhaustive list. It just means that this happens to be one of the differences between them, and therefore, Tana B'Shier. Our Tana left out other items that have the same din. And usually the Gemara in this scenario, when it says Tana B'Shier, will say, my shir, the high shir. What else is left out that it left this item out? So over here, many of the Rishonim believe that you don't have to have real Tana B'Shier. You don't have to have other items that it left out. It'd be sufficient that it just left out this one item in order to be considered an exception because of the fact that the language used here is Merubah, not Ein Bein, which is not indicating an exhaustive or a complete list. Others suggest that that's exactly what the Gemara is saying here, is that Ein Ochanami, that there is Tana B'Shier. The Tana did leave out other items, not just this item, but other items as well. And the Baal Tosafot over here lists the other items that he left out, which are, for instance, Tanat Ganav Ba'aveda, person who's doing Tanat Ganav in a case of an Aveda, or Shemesheir Shutaf Sheganav Mechaviro, a partner that steals from his other partner. And then the Baal Tosafot brings the alternate view that it doesn't matter, you don't really need to know the other items. The Baal Tosafot also point out that the Lashon Rishon, the Maiti Seata, low by the name of the Shir. According to the first Lashon that we read before, you don't have to say Tana B'Shir. The Sabra Lishon that gave him the Tani Merubah in the Marshir Kamo Be'ain. Because that Lashon already thinks the gave him the Tani Merubah in the Marshir Kamo Be'ain. He thinks that Merubah and Ein Bein are synonymous, and therefore you can't make a claim just because it uses the term Merubah that Tana B'Shir, that the Tana left out some items from the Mishnah. Right now the Gemara continues and says, Shemidah Tashlumei Kefil Noheget. Ben b'davar sheish baruch chayim, ben b'davar sheim baruch chayim. The Gemara says that the Mishnah tells us that the din of kefil applies to both animate and inanimate objects. So, menahani mile, how do you know that? The Tanu Banana pasuk from Shmot Perek Chav Gimel, which is actually in the Parshiyah Shomer Chinam, where there it says there, ki ten ish areo kesev kalim lishmor, b'gunav b'beit ha'ish, im matzei ha'ganav yishalem shnayim. Im lo yimatzei ha'ganav, v'nikra b'alabayit el Elohim. That he didn't misappropriate it, he didn't use it for himself. Al kol davar pesha, al shor, al chamor, al seh, al salma, al kol aveda. Asher yomar ki uzeh, ad Elohim, yavo davar shneem, asher yishun Elohim, yishalem shneem nereyu. So in this pasuk, it says, al kol davar pesha, which the Gemara in a second is going to say to us, that's a general statement. Then you have a list of items, shor, chamor, seh, and salma. And then you have another general statement, which is al kol aveda, on any item that would be lost. That Gemara is going to dash as a klal upratu klal. The Gemara says al kol davar pesha klal. That's a general statement. Ashur al chamor al sal sama prat. That is a detailed qualification of the general principle or a narrowing of the scope of it. Al kol aveda chazar v'klal. And then you have the kol aveda comes back and says you have a klal, another inclusive term at the end. Klal upratu klal, that is the classic case of klal upratu klal, which you say in Rabbi Shmuel in the morning. Therefore, therefore, you only extend the din based on items that are similar to the prat, to the detail that is over here. What is the common denominator between all of these items that are enumerated over here? Ma prat mifurash davar miteltel v'gufo mamon. Just here, like the prat is something that is a movable object. It's not real estate. It's non-real property. It has inherent value to it. So too, any other item that is movable, not real property, and it has inherent value, those items you are chayav kefil for. So therefore, yatsu comes to exclude karkot, shena mitaltelin. Certainly, land, real estate is not non-real property, therefore they're excluded. Yatsu avadim shukshu lekarkot. Avadim are excluded over here because they are compared, or they are treated like karka, which is in chautem, utam libnechem acharechem. They are anachala, they are your monetary ownership, similar to your field. Yatzu shtarot. Shtarot are excluded from this pasuk. She'afal pishim metalkalin, even though they are non-real property, ain gufan mamon. They aren't inherently valuable. The document is only worth something because of what's written in it and allows you to then exercise rights based on what's written in it. But the document itself is not inherently valuable. And so that's why it's not subject to kefel. Yatza hekdesh re'eyuktiv. Hekdesh is excluded over here because the pasuk also includes re'eyu, which is kiten ish el re'eyu, and therefore hekdesh is not relevant here. Balei Tosafot over here ask a simple question, which is, how do you ever have a case of kefel by toin tanat ganav? Meaning that you took a shvu'ah in order to be chayav in kefel. The way that a shomer becomes chayav in kefel is to take a shvu'ah falsely that it was stolen from him. And then the individual is found to be a thief. He took it for himself. Then he pays kefel. But he has to take the shvu'ah in order to be chayav in the kefel. But we have a principle that's laid out in the Mishnayot and Shvuot that we do not take a shvu'ah on karka. If you can't take a shvuah on karka, then how do you ever end up with a case of kefil? So the reason that you shouldn't have to be chayav by karka to pay kefil is because you can't take a shvuah on karka. So tells what it says over here. Yesh lomar, the itzrich le'echad nishba de gilgul. It says that there is a possibility that you end up taking a shvuah here, even though we can't directly obligate you to take a shvuah, but we could do it ayidei gilgul shvuah, which is the ability to wrap in additional shvuot when you already have the guy obligated to take a shvuah. Once we're doing that, we throw in the whole kitchen sink so that he takes shvuah about everything that we can try to compel him to take a shvuah. So in that case, as we saw in the Gemara in Kiddushin, which is that is zokukin nechasim sheish lein ha'achriyut nechasim shein lein ha'achriyut. If you have to take a shvuah on metalkalin, then you can throw in the karka as well, and you can take a shvuah on the karka. But then, does what says there's a secondary problem is im tomar gneiva mekarka echeshaycho. How can you have theft by land? Land doesn't move. So how do you steal land if land is a stationary object that can't be moved? One possibility is that you extend your boundaries over into someone else's property. Or in a case where you're doing that objects that are attached to the ground. They're like, when you're talking about vines that are carrying grapes. So they're be deemed to be quote-unquote karka. But there still is a possibility that you can lift them or separate them from the ground, and that's how you get gneva by karka. And so those fruits on the karka that are attached to the ground, they have a din of karka. It's a possibility that you could be gonev, you could steal such items. The other thing is yatzu shtarot. Balei Tosafot ask me here, yatzu shtarot, I don't understand why you need a miut for shtarot, because shtarot is a din in garmi. And a person who's done din in garmi would say, a person who's not done din in garmi says you're patur when you ruin someone else's shtar, or you destroy or steal someone else's shtar. And those that say that you are chayav when you're dying dine gamed, it's only a din de rabbonon that you are chayav. So Tosafot says, v'yesh lomar, it's an interesting answer, kevan, de'ite l'shtar be'en. If the shtar was actually extant right now, chayav lachzir, the gana would have to return it to the ba'alim. Sagadat chashim achzir mishalim ha'kefal imo. Since you would have to return it if you had it, then it would force them to pay the kefal along with the return of the item itself. So even though the shtarot themselves don't have any inherent value, and that is the reason that we're excluding them here, it is possible, even though there are other reasons to exclude them, and there's no reason to include shtarot at all, there are reasons why you might believe over here that a shtar should be chayav and kefel because of the obligation to return the shtar, when the shtar is still extant. Now the Gemara says, wait a minute, you have a list of items here, and yeah, you give us the common denominator between them in terms of what it includes. Yet shor, chamor, se, and salma. So Gemara wants to know, we have other things that are common denominator between them, and that should cause problems. This is identical to a Gemara that we just saw earlier on Daf Nun Dalet Amud Bet. And the Gemara goes all the way down to almost to the bottom of Samach Gimel and Aleph with a very similar layout and train of thought. That is, it begins here. Im ad prat mifurash davar shnivlato mitamei b'magam masa. Just like these items that are listed or enumerated here, are mitameh, if they're a nevela, the shor, the chamor, and the set, if they are made into a nevela, then the person who carries that such a nevela would be tameh, or a person who comes into contact with the nevela would be tameh. Av kol davar shenivlato mitameh b'magam masa. So too, the only items that should be included over here should be items that become tameh b'magam masa. Aval ofot lo, by birds, where there's no such tuma, maybe they should not be included in this din of kefo by toin tanat ganav. I says, can you really say this? Wait a minute, there's one inanimate object in the list. You have shor, chamor, and seh, but you have some salma. that's Salma should say it doesn't matter. None of this matters because that's not a common denominator between all four of them. So I'm just talking about the livestock over here. I'm not talking about the inanimate objects. So it says, why don't we say therefore about the livestock that's there? Only things that have this common denominator between them, which is by Balei Chayim that have the character trait of making tumah, that make people tumah, but magal masa, they are included in this klalu pratu klal, and they'll be chayav kefil for 20 tanat ganav. But something that does not have that character trait, they'd be excluded. Da kochad v'chad klalu prat bapei nafshi darshinle. Because now that we have enumerated a large number of details between the two klalim here, each one of those we look at as almost like an independent klalu pratu klal. And therefore we could separate between the Balei Chayim, which are three of the items enumerated in the Selma, where it says, Avalo fot lo, but based on that common denominator in the Balei Chayim, it would exclude birds. I think we're going to stop here, because this Gemara is going to continue way down the daf. Stop here, two lines down on the top of Samach Gimel Amud Aleph.